All right, before we get to the pod, I wanted to note we had some tech issues on this episode, mainly because even with Sully's great guidance, we are mostly incompetent individuals. So Pete's audio is going to be off a little bit today at points, but we made it through taping. Same great insight. High intelligent conversation, of course. And we will be back full strength on Thursday. We endeavor to do better. So thank you for sticking with us. Welcome to the pod. We had football last weekend. Austin Peay, Central Arkansas. Not surprising. Pete and I are 1-0 with our picks. We knew better.
Dan Wetzel knew better. Knew better. He had studied that FCS game big time. Sure.
He studied Tap 40, the most reliable force in sports wagering.
I waited for Pat to pick, and I went the other way. Listen, I went to UMass. I'm well aware of what crappy half-ass college football looks like, and I knew Central Arkansas was a little better at it than Austin Peay. Now, it was actually a fun game. I mean, the opening touchdown, I mean, it was great. I was really glad it was just a fun, exciting game. And the idea that these two teams got that much attention, just awesome.
Hilarious. I never saw ratings for it, but it had to be like one of the highest rated FCS games ever, right?
I bet it crushed the FCS title game from last year.
I'm sure it had to.
It's got to be the highest rated FCS game. Yeah, it was good. Yeah. It was good. Well, we'll get to college football. I want to start with basketball. We had a weekend losing a couple of Hall of Famers, all-time greats. Lute Olson, a coach at Iowa, and then Arizona, won the 97 national championship, 4 Final Fours, really cemented and built just a powerhouse in Tucson. Impeccably dressed, the hair, just a presence, right? Man, that guy, Midnight Lute, hailed from North Dakota and was that classy, right? Like, just you never know. Passed away, and obviously it was a, you know, great memory. That 97 championship team was a lot of fun. They beat 3 number one seeds, kind of got their act together during the tournament, and was one of his, you know, one of his great teams. And then, you know, John Thompson Jr., the legendary Georgetown coach, who's, I think, presence just far beyond even his great accomplishments as a coach. He also won 2 NBA titles as a player for the Celtics, a great player at Providence College. And then, was the first African-American coach to win a national title in 1984 with Georgetown. 3 Final Fours, really helped build the Big East. Incredible presence, coached all these great, Patrick Ewing, Allen Iverson, Dikembe Mutombo, Alonzo Mourning, just a slew of guys. Hoya paranoia was like nothing else. Certainly for someone growing up who loved college basketball in the Northeast, Georgetown was just massive. And John Thompson and that big, he's 6'10", he had the towel over the shoulder, and his teams were just vicious. They used to joke like the offensive rebound was their best offensive play. Just throw it up there and one of these guys would get it, you know. Just phenomenal. So and obviously he was decades ahead of his time in arguing many things about race, social justice, fairness, and different things in college basketball, you know, for a large part become conventional wisdom or agreed upon things. And he had to do it while taking a lot of darts and a lot of hate, made a lot of people uncomfortable and didn't care. Ton of respect for John Thompson.
Absolutely. Mount Rushmore figure in college basketball history. If you can only put 4 faces on the mountain, he's one of them. And that means that if you're also going to put John Wooden up there, but that means somebody between Mike Krzyzewski, Dean Smith, and Bobby Knight isn't getting on the mountain. But I'd still say he's got to be on there. College basketball needed him in the worst way when he left D.C. and coaching high school basketball in 1972, and nobody knew he was a big deal then, and Georgetown basketball certainly wasn't a big deal. But by the end of the 70s, they were going to the NCAA tournament every year, and then he got Patrick Ewing, and for 4 years, they were the best program in college basketball. They went to 3 championship games. They won one of them. They lost the other 2. One of them by 1 point on a shot by a guy named Michael Jordan. The other one by 2 points to a Villanova team that shot 78% from the field. They easily could have won 3 titles in 4 years. He was the first black coach, as you said, to win a national championship. He did it without any apology, brusque, caustic, tough, knocked through the front door. I mean, this wasn't a guy who came in playing nice or anything like that. I was like, no, we're going to do it my way, and my way is going to be tough, and we're going to be mean at times. The thing that just blew me away in that championship game against North Carolina, first of all, it was the biggest stage college basketball had ever had at that point. First time they had played in a football stadium in the Superdome. And they set it up to seat like 64,000 or whatever. Georgetown's never been anywhere near this in the lifetime of any of those players. They go out there in these uniforms that look like they cost $1.80 each with the nameplate stitched on the back by a manager or something. I mean, they look like a rummy program. And Patrick Ewing goaltends the first four baskets for North Carolina. John Thompson told him, said, do not let anything get to the rim. So he just starts goaltending James Worthy, goaltending Michael Jordan. Just this incredible show of, we are not here to mess around. And they damn near won that game, and it just launched an incredible era. Georgetown, as you said, Dan, growing up, I mean, if you loved college basketball in the 80s, especially from an urban standpoint, Georgetown was the school. Everybody had Georgetown swag. Everybody wanted to wear Nikes because of Georgetown. Profound influence by him. I can't say enough about his impact on college hoops.
The Georgetown starter jacket, man, that thing was hot. Everybody wanted the Syracuse had their run there too. St. John, I mean, the Big East was
Big East was huge.
The Big East at when I was growing up in Boston, I mean, it was practically as big as the NBA. And they had that's what the Boston Celtics were winning. I mean, it was just Monday night was like every kid at school watched the Big East. 7 o'clock, man. And it was so Thompson, these figures were all incredible, right? Boeheim's still going. Incredible, but you know, Carteseca, Thompson, Patino was in it for a while, Massimino, just every, and they just play each other. But above and beyond, Thompson was a figure. People loved him, they hated him, they were terrified. It was just phenomenal. But yeah, the starter jacket alone could put him on Mount Rushmore. That is an incredible, the Mount Rushmore of coaches. Fascinating. Fascinating there. We have to do that another time if we get some slow time. But Pete, what do you think?
Well, you know, I called around this morning to a whole bunch of different folks who John Thompson crossed paths with over the years coaching. And, you know, everybody from Rick Pitino to Mike Trangisi to Shaka Smart. And here's what stood out to me. Like, you could write entire columns on, like, the facets of his legacy, right? Just on, you mentioned the impact on the Big East. Like, I knew but had forgotten. That was the first Big East team to win a title. So he had always expressed to Dave Gavitt how much it meant to him. Dave was an assistant coach at Providence when John was a player. And so that relationship went all the way back. So, like, just the Big East part of John Thompson is its own, like, distinct, profound legacy. You have the impact on Georgetown as a school and basketball in Washington, D.C. There's obviously the cultural impact with the Nikes and the starter jacket and everything like that. Georgetown became a brand. It became this living, breathing, teeming thing. And then obviously, you know, he's the first African-American coach to win a national title. He had a just spectacular and profound legacy on African-American coaches, generations of African-American coaches. And then I just went back and read the front page Washington Post story from 1989 when he walked off the court to protest Proposition 42. Like that alone, in a nutshell, what Trangisi said to me this morning, and he said it more eloquently than I'm going to paraphrase him here, but, you know, when he did that, he walked alone. This wasn't like what we saw with the NBA, where if this is 30 years ago, radically different racial dynamics in America, a lot to risk, and he walked out by himself. You know, a true pioneer with just an intense legacy that really is, you know, I'm writing a column this afternoon trying to put it all in perspective. It's daunting to try to wrap everything in.
Intense is a great word for it. He was a very intense coach. His teams played intensely. People reacted intensely. But a couple other things, too, as far as pioneering and changing things. The Big East tournament's always been associated with Madison Square Garden, right? Well, it didn't get there until Patrick Ewing's junior year. That's what elevated the Big East profile. Patrick Ewing and Georgetown to the point like, okay, we can go to New York City and we can go to the biggest stage. Before that, you know, they're in the Hartford Civic Center, they're in the Capitol Center. It was when Ewing was a junior that they got into Madison Square. Secondly, Thompson starts winning big in the 70s, late 70s, goes to the Final Four in 82. Well, guess what happens? John Chaney gets a big job in 1982. George Raveling gets Iowa in 1983. Nolan Richardson gets Arkansas in 1985. If he doesn't have that success, I'm not sure those doors open for those other great African-American coaches.
He had the entire an entire race of coaches counting on him. Absolutely.
That's a great way to put it.
You can't, and you can't just win and have, not just win, but you can't have scandal. Because the idea was, well, they can't discipline. There's always some reason. You can't possibly be in charge. And he, one of his things was, you're coming to Georgetown and you're going to act like you're from George. You are going to graduate. You are going to do well academically. You are going to conduct yourselves. He was relentless. Like, you can't drink in the door. I mean, just, he was all over it. Walk across campus and talk to people. He had little things he told. You know, I wrote the book with Alonzo Mourning, Alonzo Mourning's autobiography, Resilience. And I'm forgetting the detail now, but what the news item was. But he walked in early on, freshman year or something like that, and he said, hey, does anyone know what happened this morning? And somebody, there was some political controversy it hit. It doesn't really matter. And nobody knew the answer. And he just cussed them out for 30 minutes for being everything they think you are. You're not aware. The damn newspaper is sold all over this thing. And if you don't read that paper, the Washington Post, every single day, you're not a Georgetown guy, right? All over them. And they all started buying the paper. And because he'd come in, what's going on today? What happened today, right? Little stuff like that. I spent 30 minutes not even practicing. And it was like, we're going to make you aware. We're going to do this stuff the right way. Because if you didn't, you're right. Those guys didn't. And not enough guys got opportunities. And he'd call everyone out for that. But he made people uncomfortable. But he was so unbelievable. He was a terrifying, like, he just was a terrifying guy. In writing that book, I'll tell one other Alonzo story. It's pretty funny. I'll tell one more after that, baby. But so I'm going to get to talk to John Thompson for the Alonzo Mourning. Alonzo's like, you know, I need Coach Thompson's voice in this book and all that. And he does not do media. So we set up like an hour to get an hour on the phone with John Thompson. Like, it takes Alonzo Mourning to get the hour. And even then, he wasn't real happy about talking to me for a whole hour, but he did it. Alonzo gives me a list of questions. I got some things I got to fill in the book, but he's got like some of these things are like stupid. They're like, why'd you pull Alonzo in the second half of the Pitt game? And I go, so now, I mean, Alonzo Mourning himself is like one of the toughest people you will ever meet in your life. Yeah. Talk about, he's terrifying. He's a friend of mine, but he's terrifying himself. Okay. I go, why don't you ask him that question? I'm not going to waste an hour on. Yeah. He's like, I'm not going to ask him. He's still scared of him. I'm like, dude, you have an NBA title. You got like millions of dollars. You survived a kidney transplant. You're scared of him. You're like 40 years old. Yeah, I'm not asking Coach that. You got to ask him about this time in practice. So half the questions didn't even make the book, but Alonzo got, you know, I was like, this is crazy. They're so scared of him. So that was him, man. He could, and I'll tell the one other that I led in the story. This to me is the most amazing John Thompson story ever. There's a guy named Rafel Edmond. Rafel Edmond was the drug kingpin of Washington, D.C. in the late 1980s. So only about 24 years old. Pete, I know you just watched The Wire. He was Avon Barksdale and then some. They talked about $300 million a year in product he was selling. Okay. Rafel Edmond was a good basketball player, but, you know, had gotten into this and was ruthless. Dozens of murders, every bit the worst drug dealer trafficker in the country. He had one of these playground basketball teams, which is kind of a thing they do in the DMV. And the summer, you get former pros, college stuff, whatever, playground guys, and you try to form these teams, and they have these little, or they did at the time, they'd have these games, people crowding around a park, watching games, betting on it, all this stuff. So Rafel gets in on the Georgetown guys. John Turner, JT, was from D.C. and knew him growing up, and he gets Alonzo on the team, and they got the two of them are hanging out with the biggest drug kingpin in Washington, and this is not good. Now, those guys weren't breaking any laws. Believe me, there was a massive federal investigation of this, but they're playing on the team and they're hanging out. And Zoe said, hey, it's like this cool guy. He's got money. I was an idiot. I was 18. I had grown up in foster care, and all of a sudden the world opened up for me. I'm in the big city. And Thompson was away that summer with the Olympics. It was 84, I think, or 88. Maybe it was 88. 88.
The Olympics. Yeah. 88, yeah.
That fall, he comes back, and the DEA, this is how big John Thompson was and how respected he was in Washington, D.C. DEA agent comes to him and says, two of your players are hanging out with Rafael Edmond, and we have an investigation going on him. Biggest drug kingpin. He doesn't know who the guy is, right? Biggest drug pin in town. This has got to break every protocol of a federal investigation.
Coach, yeah.
Coach says, all right. So he brings the two guys in. They sit down individually. He brings the DEA. He says, come back. I want you to tell them. So the DEA guys tell Alonzo Mourning, John Turner, this is who you're hanging around with. This guy does this. They kind of grill them. They've realized, like, we don't know about the drugs, anything. We don't know what the hell's going on, right? Scares the hell out of them and leaves, right? Again, has to break all federal protocols. They're willing to do this for John Thompson. John Thompson then tells these guys, I'm going to throw you out of school, whatever. I mean, this is just absolutely, we cannot be doing this. He then puts word out on the street, which is, I asked him and he didn't tell me. I don't know if he's ever said exactly how he got, quote unquote, word on the street. That he wanted Rafael Edmond to come visit him at the office. The biggest drug trafficker and a guy with dozens of murders, 2 days later, shows up at the Georgetown basketball office and sits in front of John Thompson, who then tells him, you stay the F away from my players. And not only that, these two do not get any because they're scared. Like, you can't just leave a guy like that. Like, I don't return your call anymore. Not a guy like that. Like, right. These guys get no and Rafael Edmond, who later for his trial had one witness shot and another house firebombed, okay, oh, agrees with what John Thompson says and never touches another Georgetown basketball player. Now, can you imagine any other person, let alone a college basketball coach, who can call the DEA and say, you come to me, and then I'm going to go to the biggest drug kingpin, and you come to me, and everyone does what I say. And the situation is diffused. That is respect, man. That's unbelievable.
That's juice right there. That I had heard a story that Thompson got in the car and went driving looking for Rafael. Like, was just going to go confront him on the street and didn't find him. And that's when he put out word. Yeah, you come to my house.
That might be.
Either way, it's like, wow. Talk about taking serious matters into your own hands.
Yeah.
And getting results.
We all talked kind of before we started the pod today. We were just bandying around, and they're probably between the three of us and the half century plus we've all collectively covered college basketball. There aren't a lot of like figures in the games we don't know. We haven't sat in bleachers with, talked with, have some sort of personal relationship with. But like, we were kind of like, none of us really knew John Thompson on a personal level. We all interviewed him and talked to him and everything like that. And so I think one of the advantages of the pod, and what I think people like to listen to, is like, when we talk about these people, like, you know, regular folks, like, hey, this is how I knew him. There's a funny story. Here's anything like that. I don't have anything like that about John Thompson, just from running across him and sporadically interviewing him over the years. But I will say this. I have one just searing memory of John Thompson. It's Syracuse, Georgetown. I want to say 1996. It's Allen Iverson's lone year there. They come to the Carrier Dome in January. I want to say Donovan McNabb actually came off the bench and helped Syracuse basketball win that game. It was a long time ago. Anyway, so I'm covering it. I'm 18 or 19, working for the Daily Orange. I'm freshman or sophomore in college. I don't know what I don't know. And, in the crowded little press conference room after the game, John Thompson walks in. And I had never seen John Thompson up close in person. I was like viscerally struck. He watched it. I was like, I'm not asking him any questions. He was just a giant, intimidating guy. I bring that story up because I'd be curious what your impressions were of him in person when you run across him. It was like, that was a no nonsense. I believe Georgetown lost that game. Yes, they did lose that game. So he was in no mood, no business. Now look, like, we've all been around intimidating coaches. Jim Boeheim, quite frankly, pretty intimidating, especially when I was that age. You know, there's a lot of intimidating guys. No, I have never been around a coach in a press conference room. It's like nobody wanted to ask anything. It was just like, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's like, coach, your thoughts on the game, right? You can't yell at me for that, right?
Get out of the way. Yep.
I didn't say anything. Maybe you liked it. I don't know. Your assessment of tonight. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, Bob Knight was terrifying because he could fly off the handle and go bananas at any moment. And so that was a little scary. But it's almost like it was like theater. Like you felt like if you did wrong on Thompson, you were disappointing him. And it's just like, Knight spouts off. But man, yeah, Thompson carried himself just serious. It was like, all right, this is no other coach. Even Belichick, I mean, you know.
No.
Not like that.
Parcells, no. Yeah. That's, I mean, he literally 6'10", 280 or whatever, you know. And that's in the gruff exterior. That was his shield that he wore right into, you know, when he was marching up against people. And Mike Wilbon one time told me that if he liked you, he called you an MF-er. if he didn't like you, he probably called you that too. But I mean, he was a profane dude and he suffered no fools. And just the sheer size of him, there was a gravitas that kind of preceded him wherever he went. It was funny. I'd say my one personal anecdote really with him was I was the president of the USBWA, the U.S. Basketball Writers Association, when we started the Dean Smith Award in 2015 to give to one person who, like Dean Smith, had a profound impact beyond being a really good coach. And the first winner was a slam dunk, no doubt, John Thompson, because Dean Smith loved John Thompson and vice versa. Those guys were very close friends, and I think both respected each other immensely. And I remember when Thompson got there, the banquet was in Chapel Hill, and I had to give him the award. And I'm nervous. Do not screw this up, because he's in his 70s, but it doesn't matter. It's still John Thompson. And we got it. I gave it to him and everything, and he said, "You hit me in the soft spot." I was like, oh my gosh, John Thompson has a soft spot. Wow.
Yeah, I remember he drove down to Dean Smith's retirement press conference. I remember that was a big thing. Mm. Like John Thompson, went to that and had a lot of respect for Dean Smith, and yeah, vice versa. Well, incredible guy. And like I said, I like those guys that there's no, he never courted the media, which is fine. You know, make us be better. Make us do our job. I didn't care. You know, it's no problem. He challenged us. And I know as a young guy, as a kid growing up watching him, like the things he would say would make you think. And you're just a college, I'm watching because I want to see them dunk. And, I want to see Patrick Ewing block a shot or you know, these things. But there he is taking on serious issues. And that Prop 42 that he protested, he walked out of at that time. If you did not, you failed to qualify academically, the school was not allowed to give you a scholarship. You had to pay your own way for one year.
Terrible.
That was the
terrible rule,
which he clearly pointed out is completely unfair to people who aren't rich.
Yeah.
What better thing can we do for you than bring you into college, work with you, and help you get your scholarship while you don't play? Like, that's what he was arguing. And he was the only damn coach who even walked out on this. I mean, this is not controversial anymore. But back then, it was controversial. So the NCAA leadership literally thought this was a good idea. And so some of the stuff he was pointing out, and I think people, he was really, pushing stuff. What was he pushing? Like, come on. That's just common sense. Think about how many kids came into college not academically ready, often because they came from schools that couldn't educate them very well. This was before, every kid took off for a prep school where magically everyone gets, qualified. I don't have a problem with that at all. But, this was back when if you were from, you were from Lincoln, you're from Brooklyn, you're going to Lincoln or you're going to Grady, and that was it. And you weren't just bailing out. So it just was such a simple thing that he fought for, but that was the kind of fights he had to have back then.
I really was fascinated diving down the rabbit hole of January 5th, 1989, when he walked out of that game. It was against It's against Boston College, which means you probably remember it a little better, Dan, because I would think you were in high school. You and your pops are hardcore college basketball fan too. And I spoke to Mike Jones, who's the head coach at DeMatha Catholic today, who was kind of a child of that era. He's a little in our age range. Mike Jones ended up taking over for Morgan Wooten at DeMatha. And he said when that happened in high school, like, that struck him. You know, he's like, someone who looked like me, someone who coached, which I wanted to do, that happening, like, he really took that as a seminal moment. But, I mean, it struck me that, you know, Sunday, Washington Post, A1. So, now, the front page of the Washington Post and New York Times are still a very big deal, but you could argue a generation ago, you know, without 24-hour cable news, without social media, without sort of the instant media we're in, that's the biggest megaphone, right? So if he did that on a Saturday game against BC and it was on the front page of the Washington Post, that obviously just has a huge, huge ripple effect. And so this is what John Thompson said at the time. It was to Steve Berkowitz. I've done this because out of frustration, you're limited in your options of what you can do in response to something I felt was very wrong, Thompson said 2 hours before the game. This is my way of bringing attention to a rule a lot of people were not aware of, one of which will affect a great many individuals. I did it to bring attention to the issue, to hopes of getting the NCAA to take another look at what they've done, and if they feel it's unjust, to change the rule. And it was kind of a cool scene that he basically, the game, as his players warmed up, he paced in front of Georgetown's bench, his face devoid of expression. Security scurried about, plotting the logistics of his getaway and informing athletic director Frank Rienzo of the late-breaking details. When the moment came and introductions were complete, he whirled around, flipped his towel to his assistant, and there was an idling sedan in the arena, and he just like walked out. Like what a powerful scene. Like that's, you know, just incredible.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's a great man and obviously a great coach. Pretty incredible. All right. College football. So we had a game. We got some more coming this weekend. We'll deal with later in the week. Well, you know, a little bit more of a slate of games, not just a single game. Things are progressing in some ways, and Notre Dame is going to allow 20% of a capacity, they announced, priority given to students. They're going to, so 20% of, is that about 17,000 something? I don't know what capacity Notre Dame Stadium is, but 17,000 maybe fans into Notre Dame Stadium. So that's interesting. No tailgating at Notre Dame, but that's a school not in the South, where I think we've seen a little bit more of the interest. Obviously, Indiana is allowing it, so they're going to do that. Again, I think just it's going to be classic if Notre Dame is playing football in the middle of the heart of the Big Ten and all these Big Ten schools are looking on in wistfulness of like, you know, Notre Dame fan just rubbing in the wounds of every other Big Ten fan in some office in Chicago. Yeah, going the game this weekend. What do you guys? Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, I hope that January thing works out. But not all is fantastic. Auburn announced they haven't practiced in a few days. I think they're going to get back to it on Tuesday. They had 16 players down for coronavirus-related issues, either testing positive or need for quarantine. I think, was it Oklahoma lost their offensive line also? Was that Oklahoma?
Oklahoma and LSU both lost position groups. I'm not sure if they identified them, did they? Maybe.
Whatever. It is not game week. So, you know, here we are. These things are going to happen. I think we're all aware of it. I think this is the challenge, though. If it was game week, can you play? How many offensive linemen do you need? More than four. You know, do you make all your tight ends? I mean, how do you do this? Can you play? Do you postpone? Do you? I don't know what the policy is. Do we have written policies on these types of things? Because, you know, hopefully all the Auburn kids will be fine and this is going to be too serious and they'll all be back. But what happens if this is in 2 weeks? And I think that's going to be a challenge. We may be trying to play football. We just may not be able to quite do it the way, you know, a little bit the way baseball struggled for a while. What do we know on this, Pete?
Well, what we know is that we don't know, Dan. And I really think this is going to be a fascinating, like, ethical Rorschach test for coaches as the season goes on, because there's going to be two possible scenarios. One is games you just don't want to play. And you then become more liberal in your quarantine reporting. And look, this is happening. Coaches are thinking about it, petrified of it, paranoid of it, whatever you want to say. you know, the same group of coaches who have done gamesmanship with recruiting rules and those types of things over the years, there will be gamesmanship with contact tracing protocol. I guarantee it. If you don't want to play Team X, you can make, hey, weren't you around him when you tested positive in that? And if you do want to play Game X, like I really hope that everyone has someone from the outside handling their contact tracing, because these coaches are going to be very, especially conference only schedules. You know, if you're a not very good team, instead of going 5-7, you're going to go 2-8, which there's a big difference recruiting wise, all that stuff. And just like if you are a good team, oh, all of a sudden you don't have your starting quarterback or tailback, and you don't want to run the Wildcat against, you know, some metaphorical LSU that weekend. I just really think we are going to see a lot of gamesmanship throughout this, a lot of complaining, a lot of off the record complaining, and probably you can notch the word complaining up to a different term there. I really think that so there's been conversations in leagues and the Football Oversight Committee, and I've had a bunch of conversations with ADs and coaches about this, but here's the thing. If you lose, you know, it's hard to say if you have X players you can play, because if you don't have your offensive line, you really can't play and be healthy. Does Clemson want to risk Trevor Lawrence with two converted tight ends playing guard against, you know, Notre Dame's defense? Like, these are the kinds of scenarios that are going to happen. And, you know, this is it. I think Peter King was the first person to write this, and somebody's written many versions of it. This is going to be we just have to embrace this being the weirdest, strangest, most surreal season ever. And he wrote that about the NFL. But I really think in college is really where it's manifesting itself right now. Because, like, look at Austin Peay didn't have their long snapper the other night. That dude was sailing balls. Like, he was sailing balls.
That's the only reason I lost the bet.
They had one good offensive play all night. It was the first one.
It was tied with 35 seconds left in the game. Don't tell me like this was some mismatch. Give me a break. Ooh, if they had the long snapper. If they had the long snapper, they cover. They at least cover, which is the whole point.
I'm afraid that if I asked you your unfiltered opinions of Jeremiah Oatsfall right now, we'd have to bleep out the rest of the podcast.
not going after the young man by name. He did score the tying touchdown.
Yes.
Leave him alone.
Pat Salty.
Of course. Kidding me?
Look, it's got to be like baseball where they just I wrote a column about the NFL in this. I don't know how college football does, because you can't sign more players. But you, I agree with you, Pete. You guys just have to embrace the weird and know this isn't going to work how we have it laid out. That doesn't mean we just give up. Now, if this isn't safe, if this is, you know, there's a million things can happen that you give up. That's fine. But don't give up, and I don't think anyone is, just because, well, we can't play that game, but maybe we'll be back and be. You're just going to have to embrace that this isn't going to work, but it has to work. And so until there's total it's just way too much, keep going. It's like how do you get through hell? You keep going, you know, or how do you go through hell? You keep going. Cause it's just going to be nuts. And don't not place a bet on a team until 1 minute before the damn kickoff. Then go on your bet MGM and put your wager. Like, you're crazy if you're betting on a Tuesday.
Ross Dellinger from our place at Sports Illustrated had a story today on Monday talking about a Big 12 model that has said basically you have to have at least 53 total players with a potential breakdown of like at least one quarterback, six offensive linemen, six defensive linemen, two or three receivers. Apparently the average team uses anywhere from 45 to 65 players a game. So 53 kind of splits the difference about on that. 53 is also the NFL active roster number. So you can see where that comes from. But I mean, look, you can have guys that play multiple positions. You could fudge numbers. You can do a lot of things, as Pete alluded to. This is going to be a very, very messy, inexact, and probably dishonest process at various times as we go through it.
I have a story that I'm going to do later this week, Thursday, for the opener on Yahoo. But, like, there's going to be some bad ball. I probably talked or texted, like, 30 coaches. Some said they don't think the product will be dramatically effective. The one thing that I thought was interesting was a couple coaches have told me their teams just aren't in shape right now to play, like, to practice, like, they can't practice the normal length they would do. And they all use those like GPS trackers to get like the mile per hours. And like, they just show the players are exhausted. They're not in shape. The lack of spring, like football is like a gradual buildup. There's nothing quite like it in sports, getting in like real actual football shape. When you go into fourth quarter of games, it's going to be the Hunger Games now, like, because you're going to have two teams that are tired. They're not in shape. You're going to have injuries. There's going to be more soft tissue because guys aren't in shape. I just really think that the things that will be affected the most, according to the coaches I talked to, are tackling, offensive rhythm, especially the pass game. It takes the pass game the longest to really develop some of that synchronicity that's necessary, especially the way modern football is played. And very prescient. Quite a few coaches mentioned specialty. That, you know, the special teams were not Central Arkansas' field goal unit, I may add. They were on point the other day. But yes, it's the snapping and the punting. I was talking to Luke Fickell yesterday, and he was like, as a coach, you're always freaked out about your punt game in game one, right? Any year, good years, you're always freaked out about that. But with the lack of reps, you know, those types of exchanges, and you're just having to give more reps to your backup long snapper, which you would barely ever do beforehand. So just, you know, I'm not knocking it by saying be prepared for some sloppy, because look, Pat Sully and I group texted for basically four straight hours on Saturday night about the Austin Peay game, and we enjoyed every millisecond of it, especially the final result. But the reality is, it is going to be a lower quality ball that we see this year than we normally see.
NFL too, no games.
Oh yeah,
you're walking in.
Like, people are used to, you know, everyone hates the preseason in the NFL. Well, you're not going to hate it on week one. You're going to be like, oh,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah, that's. Yeah.
I don't recall Patrick Mahomes overthrowing a guy by 15 yards before. I hadn't seen that. Yeah, it's going to be false starts, pass interference, all of that. You know what? That's all right. We'll take it. We're not getting perfect this year. Let's just get progress, get going. All right. Late last week, there was this, seemed like there was this wave of stories that the Big Ten was trying to reverse and come back sooner, and maybe Thanksgiving and maybe January or maybe post Super Bowl. Thanksgiving seemed to get the big action. I checked around. I think you did too, Pete, and I'm sure Pat did, but Thanksgiving did not seem very likely to what I had heard. Everyone was saying, well, it's a possibility, but I'd be stunned if we're doing anything before 2021. So was that just an overblown kind of social media, everyone getting excited and yelling at each other? Or was there anything there? I heard otherwise, but I'm willing to be wrong. You know, how likely is January? Can we get your Rose Bowl Michigan-Ohio State idea going? I don't know.
So I really think it was discussed by coaches, but we got to remember that this sort of moment we're in right now, dealing with COVID, is a lot like the last time I saw this was like college realignment. In realignment, the coaches knew the least, the ADs didn't know much, and it was all presidents and TV executives. Here, it's really just presidents. And I fully and firmly believe that there are many Big Ten coaches who want to start as soon as possible. And from what I heard in the coach discussions, it's really being led by James Franklin, Ryan Day, Scott Frost, Paul Christ, and Jim Harbaugh. There's a fifth. So those are also four of the five coaches that have the best rosters. So if you have a great roster and you are trying to keep NFL players on campus, you are going to discuss that. And you are probably, knowing where fan sentiment is, probably let that trickle out into the media, because fan sentiment is going to be 100% behind. We all know where the fan sentiment is, right? Like, from Nebraska to Columbus, Ann Arbor, the fan sentiment is very clearly behind playing as soon as possible. So I just really think when I made calls, the gap between coach discussion and presidential reality is a significant one. The one thing that made me think it had like an inkling of a chance is that TV is fairly interested in it. And it's basically 20% more inventory if they do it then. And like, you know, basically like, would you want a 20% raise? Like, yes. So would you want 20% more money? That would be a factor. But the presidents who made this decision would have to sit there and say, how can we rationalize this as opposed to, you know, what we decided a few months ago? And that would be some pretty thorny optics. And like later that day, Northwestern announced they weren't going to have students on campus. And I think one thing to remember when we're analyzing the Big Ten is this isn't like a rule on like where the dumb stuff conference is usually discussed, like where the conference title game is going to be, or like the kinds of rules that usually get people hot and bothered, like satellite camps or something like that. Like, this is a bigger picture health and safety issue at the presidential level. And the emotion and whims of coaches is probably not going to significantly impact it, because if it had, it probably already would have.
Yeah, this is, again, to me, this has just been mystifying, the ongoing refusal of people in the Big Ten to accept the reality that's in front of them. And quite frankly, if I were a school president now, I'd be going to my football coach and saying, would you shut up? Would you stop leaking every single possible scenario we're talking about to the media so that then they can blast out to the fans so the fans can get irrationally mad all over again? I mean, this is just, it is unbelievable to me. Everybody has said the decision is not going to be revisited to play in the fall. Now, okay, maybe Thanksgiving isn't quite technically the fall or whatever, and you could start then. And there were some coaches, I don't even know how many, but I mean, the amount of misinformation that started getting out there on Friday about a coaches meeting and it's a real possibility they could play Thanksgiving, play in the fall. No. First of all, there was a call that didn't even have all the coaches on it. And then, yes, there's a Thanksgiving proposal. I don't think it's going to get legs. I think January has the most legs. Other start dates in the winter using indoor stadiums. But the inability or refusal, really, of everyone to even try to get on the same page, I think it's just embarrassing for everyone in the Big Ten. It's embarrassing for the office. It's embarrassing for each of the league presidents. It's embarrassing for the ADs, and it's embarrassing for the coaches who keep stoking this. It's like, just be quiet, man. I'm sure they're all very upset. They want their way. They're used to getting their way. They're not getting their way. Some of them with very good teams, but I'm sorry. This is the reality of America here. A lot of people aren't getting their way about a lot of stuff this fall. That's it. Deal with it.
So, Pat, did you think something was embarrassing? I didn't quite get the time.
I think they would be better off if they just embraced the January route and was like all in on trying to sell for that and be prepared for that. I don't know whether they're hearing it on recruiting. I always think that's the key. You know, it's going to hurt them in December recruiting or whatever. They're just missing out on all the fun. But I kind of agree. It makes the league look like they're reconsidering. And again, a coach's meeting, that's not the presidents and the board of trustees out there. It's just a totally different ball game. So, and I think January football would be great. I think their system isn't that, like, I don't think that's that bad of ideally you're playing now. Absolutely. I don't know whether waiting is going to help. I think you probably were better off starting earlier. If anything, if you sit there and say, hey, we're going to give this January thing a try, we're going to play then that, I think they could turn that into some kind of positive. But I think January, February, whatever, February, March football, even if it's not the best version of the Big Ten, I don't think they're going to get the best version of anything. Could be a lot of fun and could be pretty good for the Big Ten to kind of seize their deal. All right, let's switch to something that impacts all of us. And that, of course, is the animal uprisings in this country trying to take us down.
There you go.
Humans. Reports of two different animals on the loose. Okay. They made a break from captivity and trying to roam out there on their own. We just can't have that. We have to dominate. One is a classic story. This is from Cheatham County, Tennessee. Ashland City, Tennessee. Sully, you familiar with Ashland City, Tennessee?
I am not. I was just looking it up. It looks like it's northwest of Nashville. That is not my part of the state.
Ashland City has 4,000 residents. I think they're using the term city kind of liberally. Maybe more of a hamlet. Hamlet. Anyway, Ashland City, I'm sure it's beautiful. Beautiful area. They had an animal break, but it has been done. A 150-pound African tortoise, sulcata tortoise, broke free. And was on the loose for 74 days.
74 days.
But it being a tortoise, it only made it 1 mile away.
A mile in 74 days. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. His owner told a man and a son found it wandering by the Cheatham Dam Road, nearly a mile from his house. And grazing in a valley. And so he went and got him. So it's not a hop. It's not a kangaroo, man. The tortoise tried its best, but just couldn't get there. He was brought home and got a favorite treats: collard greens, broccoli, cauliflower, carrots, bananas, and watermelon rinds. That's what a tortoise likes to eat.
Okay. The tortoise made it 71 feet per day.
71 feet per day. There you go. Quote, I guess that we'll never know the full details of Solomon's That's the name of the tortoise, Solomon. Solomon's great adventure and how he managed to elude us for all for so long. So that's great. All right, so he's back. I don't think it was an adventure. I think it was a meetup. I think the tortoises are trying to get somewhere. Probably not a big threat. I think we can handle the tortoise. However, this one is ongoing, an ongoing saga in Connecticut.
Uh-oh.
An 8 to 9. Yeah, a beefalo. An 800 to 900 pound bull, which is a cross between a bison and domestic cattle.
Wow. Okay.
I don't want to know the science how that works, but
does Randy Edsall have a bonus tied to the presence of beefalo in the state?
The beefalo. Somebody ought to. That should be like the Colorado nickname, or like their offensive line or something, right?
Yeah,
the beefalo.
Should be. Yeah.
I'm kind of rooting for this guy, even though I would absolutely grill this dude up to medium rare. He escaped on August 3rd as he's been taking off a trailer at a local meat processing plant. This is per the Hartford Courant. The animal broke free and just made a run. He knew. I ain't going in there.
Just like, remember we had the cows in St. Louis. Same
thing. Yeah.
You get them near the meat processing plant, they're like, we outie.
I heard about this joint. The animal had not been seen for a few days. It was spotted several days ago in the woods off of Route 72 near Terryville. And then the police confronted the bull on Wednesday. I mean, these poor cops have got a tough job. And this is police officers confronted the bull. As officers approached, the beefalo lowered its head and scratched at the ground, demonstrating a charge. The cops backed off and it retreated into the woods. Oh, cops are like, I ain't taking any of that smoke.
Yeah. You don't want to take a charge from that one.
No.
They said they think it's the one, but as the police captain Edward Benici acknowledged, no one's gotten close enough to check. So there is a beefalo running around Connecticut.
Beefalo at large in Connecticut. That's fantastic.
It's half buffalo, so it's not like like a cattle, pretty lame, right? This is half buffalo, and I was at Yellowstone. I saw those bison, man.
Oh, yeah.
You do not want to mess with those guys.
So do we know, like, are these things, I mean, is the meat really good? Is it more bison? Is it more steak? Is there some sort of genetic combination? What do we know? Do we know anything about what beefalo tastes like?
Well, the cops don't want to shoot it because it's somebody's property, they point out. Unless it poses a safety risk, they're not going to shoot the beefalo. There's an update 15 minutes ago. No, Current is on this, man.
Wow.
Current.com. Good job. They have a drone. They're using a drone to hunt this guy down. but he is still loose. He's in the deep woods. This could go on, theoretically, for months, Police Captain Edward Benici said. He's getting a lot of pub out of this.
We'll be on that ongoing saga.
They said the brush is so thick in that area, Connecticut could have been right on top of us and we wouldn't know it.
I did not know Connecticut had any of those areas.
Well, be careful out there, everyone. All of our Connecticut listeners, this is not one you want to apprehend in itself. But if you do, invite me over for a Labor Day barbecue because we're going to going to do all right when you got 800 pounds of beefalo. All right. That'll do it. We'll be back Thursday. For more fun with college sports, please subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for listening. Share us on social media. Leave us nice reviews. And we'll be back with big predictions for week one. We just had week zero. Now we'll have week one of the college football season. We're kind of there, man. We're kind of there. Talk to you then.
I'm Mike Lizikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News.
And I'm Dan Kleidman, Editor-in-Chief of Yahoo News.
We're the hosts of Skullduggery, a podcast that not only breaks down the news, but also breaks news.
We deliver authoritative analysis while drawing intriguing historical parallels from our decades of covering D.C. scandals.
With our current focus on the president and his administration's handling of the coronavirus, to the 2020 elections, we interview those helping to shape the stories.
So subscribe to and download Skullduggery wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media at Skullduggery Pod.